Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Good morning. Good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are, whenever you are. Welcome to another GoTo Unscripted session with me, Kevlin Henney. And today I'm joined by Hadi Hariri from JetBrains. So Hadi, please introduce yourself. Tell us a bit about what it is that you do at JetBrains and, you know, kind of things that interest you at the moment.
Oh, well, my name is Hadi. I work at JetBrains as on developer advocacy, which is, you know, for folks that still don't know, it's helping developers get a grip on technology and advocating for our tools, etc. And what interests me at the moment, guitars. And I don't know. I mean, I've been around the industry for I can't even remember how old I've got more gray hair. You know, every time I go to the hairdresser, I remember when I first went to the hairdresser and they were cutting my hair, and I'm like, oh look, there's a gray hair, and now it's like, oh look, there's a black hair. There. I've been in the industry for a very, very long time, and I think my latest passion has been seeing how we constantly go around in circles, and we're just kind of like entangled ourselves in a web of complexity that we can't seem to get out of. We just keep increasing.
Yeah, and I think that it's interesting. The complexity thing is, I don't think I ever had to talk about complexity until I entered software development, and I mean that in the kind of like when it comes up in conversations or even stuff I did at university, and I didn't do computer science first time around at university, but I remember the first job I had after university, one of the greatest insights I had from my project manager, who was technical, is he said, oh, Kevin, actually, all of this, it's about managing complexity. And, you know, it was not quite, you know, I saw the summit of the mountain and understood, but it really reframed the whole of software development. It's just, okay, that's what we're trying to do, is doing that. And then there's kind of like the follow-on question is like, and how good are we at it? It seems to be that we are very good at manufacturing or creating complexity.
Oh, yeah, we're the best.
It's just like, you see that simple problem? We can take that and make it more complex. So when you think about complexity, when talking about developers, because, I mean, as a developer advocate, that means you're in contact with a lot of people and you see a lot of different things. And people are going to ask lots of different questions or come at you with a different angle. And I guess there's sometimes a hidden agenda that they don't realize. And it's, you know, how does this tooling or this language, whatever, solve this? And you kind of scratch a bit further and you're thinking, well, what are they actually asking?
Yeah.
You scratch a little further and they're probably asking something that is to do with a hugely created complexity of theirs. It's like, oh, okay, right. I would not want to solve that problem because I wouldn't want to be there. But now you've got it, that's kind of interesting. So this idea of, you know, Brooks called it accidental complexity as opposed to the essential complexity. So do you think that's endemic in the industry? Is that just part of what we do, or is it part of who we are?
I think it's part of who we are with help from the industry. the majority of us that, you know, got into software development, I speak for myself, I got into it when I started to realize how much I love automating things. And that was just like, it was like, this is brilliant, you know, like I can automate stuff. And then at some point it clicked like, oh, look, I can automate stuff and help people be more efficient. Mm. And on top of that, I'm getting paid for it.
So it becomes a profession, it becomes a career.
It's brilliant, right? So, but that idea of tackling a problem and trying to find a solution for it, I think that's part of us, right?
Yeah.
And we all enjoy that. The problem is that often we get lost in forgetting what the problem is and just, you know, trying to play with the solutions that the industry offers us, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's an interesting one, because that's one of the observations that I've had, because occasionally I get asked, what is it that makes a good developer? You know, what is it, if you're going to be a programmer, what is it that you, what are the things? And, there's historically, you need to have good mathematical skills. Not so much, and there's all kinds of different things. And you eventually meet so many people, you go like, well, okay, actually it's not any of the standard things. But there do seem to be a couple of common threads. And one of them, exactly as you said, is that problem solving. There has to be something within you that probably drives that. And that's regardless of any kind of other background you have. But I think one of the other things that makes the perfect storm is that perhaps there's also an element of creativity. And you put those two together, and we're able to create some amazing problems that we solve.
Exactly.
it's a perfect storm. And so therefore we love that kind of tinkering, that possibility of I wonder what this tool gives me, I wonder what this API does, and what if, and if I do this, and if I have this call back to, and it's very easy to escalate. And as you say, you forget the original problem. It's that kind of, you get into the flow state.
Yep, exactly.
but you get swept away by the flow.
Yeah. Then as the saying goes, a solution looking for a problem, right? I've got this brilliant thing. I don't know what it's solving, but it's brilliant, right? It's fantastic. Yeah. So I think it is a combination of both, and I don't think it's ill-intentioned. I don't think any of us go about saying, I'm going to come up with the most overly complex architecture I could possibly come up with. I mean, imagine that in any other field. Building bridges. Oh, well, I'm not just going to build a bridge to cross this pond. I'm going to over-engineer it in case tomorrow we need something else. And yet we do that all the time. All the time. I mean, I've seen yesterday, actually, we were doing a recording of my podcast. And this section is brought to you by Talking Kotlin Podcast.
So check it out.
And, we were talking to the guest that had written a book on design patterns. And we're talking about how the whole gang of four and how, what is the worst thing that you've encountered over your lifetime in terms of overuse of design patterns. Mm-hmm. And I clearly remember when I was doing consultancy, going to a customer that had actually a code base that had organized their code based on folder names of design patterns, right? I'm not kidding you.
Okay, I'm going to just roll my jaw straight back up there.
I'm not kidding
you. That trumps the story I have on that one.
And it's just like, because he was the guest was saying about how, someone had said, I've actually managed to use most of the design patterns in the Gang of Four book. And it reminded me of that time where I had... you could structure your code based on features, on MVC, whatever. No, this was on design patterns. Like, I have all my decorators here. I have all my strategy patterns here.
Yeah. Wow, that's. And it's an interesting one, because I think there's I think this kind of ties into sometimes the way that we create. We mistake one thing for another. So I've been into design patterns for a while. In fact, I remember the time before design patterns. And it has always distressed me that people have misunderstood them. And some people treat them as a checklist. There's a set of principles I need to check off. And it's just like, you do know there are more than 23 design patterns. And actually, the 23 in that book aren't really very contemporary or well-aligned. It's a good first step. That book is 30 years old as of next year. And it's just like, really impressive, But they did not intend, that was never their goal. And when you understand design patterns, like, you're supposed to be solving problems. And then people sort of, it's a checklist. And I remember my own kind of horror story, but honestly, having folders organized by design patterns, that beats it.
Yeah, that was...
Yeah, because we actually, we talk about that in Pattern-Oriented Software Architecture, Volume 5, I wrote with Frank Bushman and Doug Schmidt. We kind of talk about how people misunderstand it, and they start thinking of these things as like checklist items, or, they're like components, and therefore you add them to one another. And we actually demonstrate you cannot have exactly the architecture you described. That's actually not possible if you are writing sensible software. But I remember just one company, and it was like, I was looking at the code, and I just couldn't understand what was going on. And I thought, oh, I've just been in the car for 2.5 hours. Maybe, I'm just staring at the road. And maybe I'm not just missing something here. And eventually, it was a very slow penny. It dropped. And it was a notification relationship based on Observer, and it was built up to be something like MVC. And I said, you've got the callbacks going the wrong way. And the guy said, oh, right, okay. And I said, but you told, it's actually fairly clear. You've got to really understand the motivation of this and read through that. He said, I'm a senior developer. I don't need to read the words. I just look at the code in the book and it's just like, well, clearly that's not how this works, because it's all a discussion about what you're supposed to be thinking, and then here's some code to demonstrate what we're thinking. It's not a copy and paste exercise.
Yeah.
But that thing, and that they eventually, at that, I remember discovering that team had actually pretty much, they did a pattern a day. There are 23 design patterns officially in that book. It's about 23 working days in the month. It was pretty much, what day is it today? I think today's Singleton Day. Didn't we have that last Tuesday? Oh, we always say, we always fill the extra days with Singleton.
And they've already had it printed out calendar.
I remember mentoring some developers a few months later from this team. And when I kind of hit the section design patterns, everybody went like this. And I thought, what has happened? How has the earth been so poisoned that these people? And then they told me some of the designers says, yeah, there's this bit where there should be a flag. So we use the state pattern.
Yeah.
It's just like, actually, what you want is a flag. It's an if statement. That's it. Sometimes an if statement is just an if statement. That's just fine.
Exactly.
And they had created this amazing thing. And it was very enterprise-y in the worst sense of that word.
Yeah. I talk about seeing this in other code bases. I've done it myself, right? I mean, when I started out, and not even when I started out, for many years, I was over-engineering everything. I was creating these abstractions, and I was creating interfaces that only ever had a single implementation. I wrote the other day on this social media. It's called Twitter.
I've heard of it. Yeah.
I said, we build in these flexibilities and clean architectures to try and, use them at some point in the lifespan and end up creating these complex code bases that don't make use of everything that we've foreseen, right? And I look at my own code bases, and it was exactly that. I would create these monstrous code bases of abstractions and flexibility and, throw in a DLL or a jar and it'll instantly recognize it. Like, did I ever use that? No. Yeah. Did I ever need it? No.
Yeah, it's the whole what if, and this actually, interestingly enough, goes with the what I mentioned about the creativity. And it turns out the more imagination you have, the worse this gets, because you're imagining all the possible futures. Yeah. And so your skill at imagination, there's absolutely nothing wrong with imagination. It's an immensely powerful tool. But the danger is we kind of take a speculation and we embed it as a commitment in the code. And exactly as you confess, so this is going to be a confessional. I've definitely done that, and I've kind of looked at those things, and sometimes you kind of look at them a few years later, and it's always one of those things. It's always good to go back to things that you wrote or worked on in the past and kind of get that kind of sense of like, and how do I feel about that now? And we often don't do that, but it can be quite healthy.
I wasted my life.
Well, okay. At that point, maybe I should have just sold ice creams and made more people happy. Who doesn't like an ice cream vendor? but there's a humility that comes with that. And, but sometimes there is this kind of like, sometimes you kind of get that sense of like, I was wrong about that. But perhaps the thing about, you talk about helping other people, and sometimes the thing is, maybe we can't save ourselves, we can save somebody else.
Exactly.
And I had this opportunity with a team a number of years ago, visited them over a number of years. And one of the most interesting things is we got to the end of the sunset period of that, it'd been over a decade. So how did that go? It wasn't a formal retrospective, And one of the guys said, all those times you said we were over-engineering and that, you were right. Because we also said, did any of the shortcuts taken for deadlines and any of the over-engineer or the extensions and generalizations that you put in that we discussed and debated, did any of those work out? And it's just like, no. And it turns out that the greatest value that they had was in separating stuff and keeping it simple.
Yeah.
And just, it really was, and that was a hugely hard, but they became one of the best teams I've ever worked with. But they found that actually just keeping things kind of small and simple and comprehensible and tested and all of this kind of stuff was actually, I mean, it took an immense amount of discipline. It turns out it's harder to do that than it is to create complexity. But that was the thing that actually they said that was the biggest game changer in the long term.
Yeah. And we have this at so many levels. I mean, you know, now, you know, before I was listening to some of the interviews, and I mean, every time you talk about software now, you hear Kubernetes, you hear Docker, you hear microservices, you hear nanoservices, Pico services, you hear whatever services you want, right? And it just sometimes makes me wonder why.
Like, yeah.
Why are we doing all of these things?
Yeah.
Right? And like, it's...
Why are we doing this to ourselves?
You know, it's... it's like, back in my day, you know, back in the old days, I mean, even the web development stuff, right? We used to do this thing called, there was an application, there was a CGI or an ISAPI, and it used to spit out some HTML combined with data, and it used to render a web page, right? And it used to work. And then someone said, no, users need instant updates. So we're going to invent this whole thing called single page application, right? 20 years later, you're coming back to articles that are saying, oh, to get better usability and performance, we're going to do this thing called server-side rendering. It's like, right, that's what we used to do
cycle.
25 years ago. It was called, you know, CGI.
Yeah.
Well, CGI is serverless now, right? Do you remember CGI?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It's like you used to call an executable, right? Now you call a function and they call it serverless.
Yeah.
And now we're driven to this whole cloud native, right? Which for me is fascinating because, I mean, if you take a look at any of the cloud providers, I'm not single pointing out anyone, but you take a look at Google Cloud providers, you take a look at Azure, you take a look at AWS. AWS, the other day I was scrolling through the services they provide. It's like 20 pages of services that they provide that you don't even know. Like, you have to take a course to figure out what it is that you need to learn to then take a course on that, to then figure out what you need to do. And then by the time you finish all of that, it's already obsolete or legacy, and they've come out with a new service. And, you know, take that, because when I was saying to you that the industry kind of helps motivate us to do this, right? Take that, combine it with our eagerness to solve problems and to automate stuff, and you're like, ooh, look, shiny little toys. Oh, I can play with all of this and put all this together and create this massively over-complex, scalable architecture that no one's ever going to use.
Yeah.
For what?
Yeah. And I think that's that kind of idea of trying to understand there's a feedback loop that we're sometimes missing. And it's just like, so exactly you said, the scalable thing I think is absolutely fascinating because many people say, oh, well, we do this to be more scalable. Well, what is it that you're doing? You know, do you have a scalability problem? No. And it turns out that they are borrowing, you know, the standard thing, go to a conference, you see the big names, make their recommendations or talk about their architecture. And these people are, you know, the Googles and so on, they are doing planet-wide engineering at this level. Yeah. And the point is that what is it that you're doing? You know, I know somebody who wrote software for a funeral company. And, you know, although... You know,
how scalable that going
to
be?
Yeah, you know, how scalable do you expect that to be? By the time you start hitting that kind of curve,
that's
you have
not your problem.
Trust me, software is the least of your worries. You know, it's and that was the whole thing. And he were there, and he did one generation of the product. And now a larger team, two people generated the first, developed the first generation. Now a larger team was in, and they were rewriting, and it was all microservices this, microservices that. And he said, well, they spent an awful lot longer. Apparently doing a lot less, but there appears to be a lot of code. Most of the code is as it were feeding the frameworks. You know, the framework says I want to do it. The framework that was supposed to make things easy, you're now bowing before. Oh, you want this? You want this? Yep. I need to feed you that. I need to respond to this. And suddenly, it's not that there is no case where these are may be reasonable, but the result for the developers is that they are constantly feeding this, and somewhere in the heart of that is the idea of the business and the user. It's sort of lost in there, and there's all of this stuff, and that's a really common experience. I see it in the blog space as well. I see lots of practices that are being recommended as good, that are reversals of the simplifications that we've been encouraging people for a long time. Yeah. And it's kind of like, what drives this? And it's again that idea that sometimes, you know, you say the industry, but also sometimes when I make something look intricate, it makes it look like it's a solution. And again, going back to, as you said, it's a solution in search for a problem. And I've seen so many recommendations there. And you say, oh, why don't you just create an object here? Oh, but you might want to change this and that, so we're going to parameterize it and do this. And before you know it, you know, you're shooting up and injecting everything. And it's just like, but you could just create an object just right there. Right there, in that line of code. And that would be it. And that, you know.
Yeah, I know. And it's
addictive.
Yeah, it is. And there's conferences, blog. I mean, I remember when this happened. It was kind of like the first time I had heard of Uber, right? Because, I mean, I lived in Spain. Well, I still do. You know, Uber only came to Spain a couple of months ago. We got strong union taxis, taxi unions. And there was this blog post of, you know, how Uber went from Postgres to MySQL for performance. It was back in 2013. And I just saw a whole bunch of folks saying, oh yeah, I have this problem. No, you don't. No, I do. I got to move to MySQL as well. Yeah, and then another one's like, so why are you using MySQL? Well, because Postgres is crap. Why? Well, look at this blog post. Right, okay. 2016, Uber comes out with another blog post, moving from MySQL to Postgres, right? Now, it could have been the other way around or whatever, but in the interval of 3 years, I'm like, you could have just not read that blog post and saved yourself a lot of money.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's like, we just copy everyone, right? Yeah. Because it looks cool, it looks interesting. We're gonna do chaos monkey engineering. Do you ever need that for your funeral home? No, but it's bloody brilliant, isn't it?
I think that's the interesting thing. And it goes back to the kind of like the not getting the point of design patterns type thing. It's another one of these kind of ideas of not understanding the full idea. Is that a lot of these people, you know, the Ubers, they are dealing with particular scales. Well, these people are solving problems that they have, but it doesn't mean it's your problem.
Exactly.
And that's the idea. It's like, we should take these as data points in a large landscape of like, that person in this situation had this particular problem. They identified it this way. This is the pain it caused them. This is where they started. This is where they ended up. And their journey continues, and they may do an about turn, which is exactly what you've described. But that's the point. Now, the question is, do you have that problem, or are you just looking at the surface waves, the surface ripples? The easy thing, which is they made this migration. We must make that migration. Yep. And it's like, you know, as you said, we like to copy things. And that is one of humanity's greatest skills and failures, you know, copying. It's one of the things we're really good at. You know, it gives us stuff like civilization, written language, all of this kind of stuff. It's just like, yeah, copying, absolutely amazing. But it also gives us fashion and overuse of microservices and stuff like that, you know.
Yep. And we have the same with microservices. You see now articles about going back from microservices to monoliths, right? I mean, you know Simon Brown, right?
Yeah.
And he said it clearly. It's like, if you don't know how to write a proper monolith, microservices aren't going to help you. You're just going to end up with a lot of little
really badly
bad monoliths. That's where we are.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting observation, because again, it goes back to one of the most important things for me that I learned originally in trying to learn about patterns, not just this Gang of Four stuff, but actually going back and trying to understand, is that for me the greatest insight I had was trying to understand, oh, this is about context. What you're trying to do is say, I've got this problem in this context. I don't just have this problem. I have this problem in this context. Yes. And if that context changes, then the nature of my problem changes. If my context is different to your context, and that context can be as anything as detailed as a programming language. You know, I'm in a particular programming language. I am following these practices. So if I'm in a programming language where I have to manage the memory myself, there are going to be a set of problems that I have, and there are also probably a set of practices that I can follow that keep me on the straight and narrow. But I can't simply transplant that to a managed language and say, oh, look, I'm using the same techniques, because it's just like, well, no, you have some memory problems, but they're different, and the tools available to you are also different. In other words, you are not in the same context. Yeah. And this is the idea, we like to have the one rule, you know, oh, one rule, and now we're going to solve it that way.
Yeah.
And we've ended up with exactly this. So sometimes people are moving to microservices for the right reasons, but whenever anybody says we're moving to microservices because we've made a mess of engineering something that's a monolith, it's just like, and what makes you think that you're going to not make a mess of this. If you're moving to microservices for, you know, the elasticity, the flexibility, and all the other kind of performance characteristics that hits the mark, microservices will always make a piece of code more complex, or they will make the architecture more complex. But there's this the equivalent, put it all in one place. But then if you're doing it for reasons of structuring, maybe you get lucky. Maybe you do end up with a better architecture. But the chances are you're going to end up with the same problems because it's probably developed by the same people.
Why are we going to think it's like it was our code all along?
It wasn't
the platform. It wasn't the architecture. It wasn't any database. It was our code.
We have met the enemy and he is us. Yeah. And I think that's the interesting thing, that many people are not confronting this. And I think, you know, and that's one of the, you know, it's one of the lessons of history, given that we both have grey hair, one of the lessons of history is watching it being repeated. And there is that observation, you know, there are a couple of observations, the classic one being, you know, those who do not understand history are doomed to repeat it. But there's the counterpoint to that, which is those who do understand history are doomed to watch it being repeated. And, you know, we can't always extract all of the right lessons, but there is this thing. And you kind of threw in the pico-services, nano-services thing earlier. I thought that was an interesting one.
Well, I mean, you see it. I mean, like, sometimes when the whole microservices came out, you just... There were times that you had to facepalm when you would hear conversations of like, how many classes constitute a microservice, and how many lines of code is a class with a single method a microservice, or is it a nanoservice? Like, why are we having these types of conversations? And then on top of this, I mean, you talk about patterns, and we talk about architectural patterns, and you talk about microservices, and then when you, like, the CQS, right? Command and query separate.
Yeah.
Many years ago, I'm pretty sure you're familiar with CQRS that
yes.
came about, right? Which, if you were around back then, which you were, we were,
yeah.
if you would actually Google CQRS, Google would respond, "Did you mean cars?" Like, it used to say, "Did you mean cars?" There's actually a blog, which is CQRS.com. Blogspot or something like that, and the tagline is "Did you mean cars?" Because Google didn't know what CQRS was, right? And so Greg Young, who was yeah. talking about CQRS, was also doing event sourcing.
Yeah.
And then people thought that, well, if I'm doing CQRS, I have to do event sourcing, and they started to like add this complexity of event sourcing to situations and contexts that didn't apply. And it's just like, no, we got to do CQRS with event sourcing, and it's not well, it's not working out well, oh, because you're lacking domain driven design. Now you got to throw in the domain driven design, now you're going to get all of that. And we keep seeing like how we keep adding these levels of complexity to things instead of just thinking about, hey, you know what CQRS is? It's just about having your read separates from your writes.
Yeah.
You know, it's about not needing the ORM at times, right?
Yeah.
And we do the same with microservices. Oh, you're using microservices? Yes, then you need to use, Kubernetes. Why? Well, because you can't just, you know, deploy a container. Why? Well, because you need Kubernetes for scale. Okay, but I don't have scale. Doesn't matter. Just in case you need it. And then you need all of these monitoring services, and then you need to... Yeah.
It does become, and exactly as you say, there's this kind of, you go to pick one off the shelf, but then a bunch of other stuff comes with it. Have you thought about this, sir?
Yeah.
Madam, how about one of these
like,
and one of those?
You go to a car showroom, you know, it's like, oh, well, now that you're getting a car, you might as well get this upgrade.
You kind of walk in, you're really simple, you know, I'm after a motorbike, and you walk out with just like a camper van, and it's just like, and that's the point, is every single one of the ideas that we're talking about is individually useful, it has an appropriate place, an appropriate time and place, and there's no criticism of these things at that level. But then it's just the, you know, it's that kind of like shiny hammer syndrome, and you eventually end up asking the question like, you know, is this the right hammer for this screw? It's just like, it's a complete mismatch. But more importantly, you just then start dragging all these other things by association. Oh, if you're doing this, you need this, yeah. I mean, it's worth considering them, but you don't necessarily need it. And that's where I think, you know, going back to the heart of this, the complexity, where does it come from? Is this aggregate kind of quality? It's like, it's got this gravitational field that pulls in all these other things. And as you say, CQRS in principle is a profoundly simple idea that can benefit a whole load of architectures. Hey, you can have a different read stream from a write stream, you can optimize them and have different technologies, as long as you're happy with the data quality differences. If you have that kind of, this is brilliant, absolutely fantastic. And suddenly you've got something else there, which, you know, the big break there is breaking from, you know, kind of ACID transactional tyranny, let's call it, where we have to lock everything and lose all kinds of scalability. And this is great for a large class of things. That's fantastic. But then, as you say, let's throw in the event sourcing. Let's throw in this. And suddenly it's just like, and are we doing this with microservices? Because that sounds like microservices. And then you draw in that domain as well. But I think that the funny thing that for me with the microservices stuff is watching, again, that historical aspect being repeated, because when people coined that term around it, the first time I saw anybody talking about microservices was Fred George, and that was about 10 years ago. And he had a really clear idea. He was very clear about how he was doing it and what he was doing. And it was genuinely to do with, like, we want small pieces. We want something that you can actually, an individual developer can write easily and will be quite happy to pretty much throw away and write again. And these days, and he had a very clear, the word micro was justified in what he was advocating. And these days, when people talk microservices, you kind of look at it and go, like, I remember the whole kind of services the first time around. And you've now created stuff that's now bigger than what everybody was accusing. And so now we need to scale down. We're at Pico, and it goes down to
And it's so tightly coupled that if one service goes down, the whole system goes down. Yeah. But that defeated the purpose of the thing. No.
Yeah. It's interesting because there are a couple of phrases. And I know that Frank Bushman and I did a talk where we actually took an excerpt from Clemens Sapersky's book on component software in the late 90s. Really important book, really talking about, you know, the thinking and so on and the rationale behind it. And a lot of that stuff also seemed like almost old, because he was very good at giving a historical context and a narrative there. And it's funny, we took a paragraph out of it and just what is a component, and it was identical to what is a service just a few years later, the SOA style service, and is identical to what we would now call microservices. It was so funny, it was just this particular paragraph, and you know, you either had to change no words or one or two words, and it was just like, we've been here before. And it's not that none of these are any, they all make progress in some way, and they're all helpful to a large class of systems. But when people come up and say, this is going to help us, in what way? We're not sure. Because other people are doing it, it will give it, you know, we have faith, you know, and we'll be blessed by the right outcomes.
And it reminds me of when you said the definition of a service. I remember back in the WCF days. Remember WCF? And so they had come up with the four tenets of services by Microsoft. And there was four, right? And it was... the four, WCF complied with the four tenets of services, but of course Thomas Earle had 11, right? But you didn't need the 11, the four was enough, right?
Actually, I'd forgotten that distinction, yes. Yeah. So there's an interesting kind of cycle there, and it's kind of like, you know, it's almost like there's a merry-go-round, and what we want to do is each time round, we want to be aware that we're going round. And just like, you know, it's just like, hey, this time around we're doing it like this, and we've called it this, and we're totally aware of that, and let's not fall into the same traps regarding silver bullets and, you know, hey, guess what, you know, this is the silver bullet that will do this. Haven't we fired off a bunch of silver bullets before? I'm pretty sure we have. You know, I've got kind of the wounds to show it. Haven't we, let's just understand the thing that this does give us, and then there's all these other things, and be really clear in our minds that these are not necessarily going to happen by magic. This is why we want this technology, because this is the difference it makes to us, you know, as opposed to all of these other things, which genuinely get a bit cargo culty.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, there's many people that argue unfairly that we're just, you know, we're coming up with new solutions, we're trying to find new ways to solve the same problems, and so on and so forth. But one of the things that I've found a lot, again, with us is that, you know, let's say that I have a framework, okay? And that framework works for 80% of the cases. And now I need a special case that doesn't cover it. So I won't, you know, make a special case. I will create a new framework that covers my cases and a little bit more. And I do that at the expense of complexity. I do that at the expense of, I'm not taking something that we know, building on it, and abstracting the complexity away. I'm making the developer have to deal with that complexity. I'm making them have to deal with the complexity of learning the framework, learning everything underneath it. And I don't understand that part. You know, it feels like we are trying to, every time we talk about applications and user experiences, we always try and say, let's make the experience more pleasant for the user. Let's not make the user have to understand the application in you know that they've got to go to three menu items to accomplish what they want to do. And yet we don't seem to apply that to ourselves. Like as developers, we don't say, let's try and abstract away things to the point that it makes it simpler for people to use, as opposed to, you know, I mean, if you take a look at any of the frameworks, like I remember, you know, we were just joking earlier about, I gave a talk on AngularJS. Yes, it was a horrendous mistake I made, right? And then ReactJS came about, and then there was this flux architecture of ReactJS, which is this massive diagram of all of these parts, and you're like, why? Like, what? Why do I need to understand all of this, right? Why? I mean, it was easier to understand machine code. Seriously, the 68,000 Motorola assembly was easier than programming with ReactJS. And I don't get it. I really don't. I think we just, like, we enjoy complexity.
I think it becomes its own reward. It's like it's like a puzzle. You know, again, that's the other aspect. It's like these aspects, creativity, problem solving, and they're in that we find puzzle solving, and And complexity has its own reward, its own intricacy, and there can be a lot of fun when you created something like that. I mean, I think, in that sense, software development is one of the most creative professions that we have. You literally can create something from nothing. You can summon things from the universe. You know, in times past, you know, developers would have been, you know, burnt at the stake. You're casting magic. And although some people may have the opinion that that should be continue to be the case, I'm definitely not going to advocate that. But we do have this invitation to complexity. Because there's so much to know. I mean, that's the thing, is that there's so much to possibly know, but perhaps sometimes we don't make it easier. Although, going back to your point, earlier on, nobody ever sets out to over-engineer things. Nobody has the meeting and said, so we're going to develop this. And so, any suggestions for how we should do it? I think we should over-engineer it beyond comprehension, but we should do it under the veil and mandate of simplicity. No, nobody's going to say that. And if somebody does say that and you're in that meeting, you know what to do. You stop, and actually, if it's a Zoom meeting and you happen to be the host, you can just kind of accidentally kick them out. You know, oops, your connection was dropped. You know, the point there is, but that opportunity doesn't happen. That's not how it happens. It happens over time, and people go in with such good intentions. Every single framework is always an attempt to simplify, but then things start leaking out, leaky abstraction, and you sort of end up having to say, I now need to know the universe in order to use this. There is a common cycle there.
And then even like with presentation patterns, and like, you know, we talk about MVC. Simple concept. Okay, MVC, now I'm doing a desktop application. MVP, okay, now MVP doesn't quite work. I'm going to do MVVM. Okay, what's MVVM? Well, there's this long blog post of 17 pages that tells you the subtle differences between MVP and MVVM. And then, you know, 6 months later, now MVVM sucks. I'm going to do MVI. And it's just, and when you look at it, it's basically the same thing, just someone decided to call it differently. You know?
Yes, I must confess that's been my... The funny thing is that a lot of it is like, wait a minute, isn't that just a variation of that? Should we not acknowledge that? But in other cases, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of MVC stuff you look at and go, well, having been familiar with the original MVC, it's just like, yeah, it's not quite what we had in mind, but, you know, there's calling different things the same name, and then there's calling things by different names that are actually essentially variations of the same idea.
Yeah.
It seems we have, you know, naming is one of the hardest problems we know.
Yep.
But there is that idea, and we like to explore the space. As you say, we're all trying to solve different things, but it's a sense of like we are repeating some of the same mistakes rather than finding new mistakes to make.
Yes.
That's a problem. You know, that's the thing we should be doing, is there's a lot of innovation to be had, but we spend a lot of time, I think it's necessary, we always repeat certain mistakes, and certainly as an individual in the profession, you have to go through certain mistakes that you're going to make. Nobody can think for you, nobody can understand your code. You know, you have to go through that. So, but it does seem collectively we are capable of making some of the same mistakes. It's kind of like, shouldn't we mark that one as done so we can make new and exciting mistakes that actually push us into different spaces rather than hovering in the same areas.
Yeah. And then when you've been in the industry as long as we have, and you start saying, oh, but that, we kind of, and you're like, oh, shut up, you know, old man screaming at the cloud or whatever. It's like, oh, I'm not really. I'm just.
Yeah, but I actually did have that one experience. I thought, you know, when somebody showed me something and said, oh, you're doing that, that's asynchronous. Okay. Have you had this problem? Yeah, rather than saying, oh, yeah, we did this back in the day, shout at cloud, you know, it's just like, have you had this? Yeah. It's just like it's like you've seen our code. Yeah, it is.
Yeah. 40 years ago.
Yeah. And so there is an element there. Yeah, it's interesting because we're a knowledge-based profession, and yet surprisingly, and we are very good at individually learning certain things. It's just like developers are always tracking moving targets, so their skill at learning is great. But there's the kind of the bigger learning that we're not necessarily so good at collectively. And there seems to be a kind of like a kind of a paradox there almost.
Yeah.
So you mentioned something earlier on. We were talking about, you know, building web services talking about microservices, but really all of this kind of like stuff of like, I want to put something out there so that other things can communicate with it. You've been working on something recently that is in that kind of space.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm on the KTOR project, which is an open source framework that we've developed at JetBrains for creating microservices. it's for creating connected systems. So essentially, it's like it's a multi-platform because it's written in Kotlin.
Yeah.
So it's multi-platform, meaning that you can actually like now build with the 2.0 release that we just released. You can build servers using Kotlin native, which means no JVM, nothing.
Yeah.
Just targeting, you know, binary. Like in the old days, you know, like the compilers and linkers and get your EXEs. And then it's got a client, which is also multi-platform, so you can use it on iOS and mobile and all of these different things. Yeah.
You see, because I had a quick look at that, and I thought, oh, this is quite interesting, because it seems that, curiously enough, the thought went through my head. Kind of validated by what you just said. I thought, that's reclaiming some lost territory here, because actually it does look, I mean, I can't, you know, if somebody wants to look at this interview in 5 years' time, go, yeah, he was wrong.
that
turned out to be terrible, you know. We'll do a review. But just at the level, but a couple of things there. One was the Kotlin native aspect. And I thought, actually, interesting thing in terms of Kotlin does seem to have stuck to its, you know, it's now just over 10 years old. And it seems to have stuck fairly closely to its original vision of basically, yeah, we want to program something like Java, but there's a lot of extra noise in that. And there are so many things that we do that are common that should be brief. You know, those things which are common should be shorter type thing. Whereas justifiably, Java gets that as a criticism that even doing the most trivial thing, it's not that it's not possible, it's just that you've got to spend a lot of time doing it. And if you're getting paid by the line of code, this is a magnificent solution. Absolutely, you know, ignore every recommendation we make in this talk. But there is that idea of, actually, it seems to have stuck fairly close to that mission statement and seems to have optimized in that space. And it goes back to that idea of the developer user experience. You know, the developers are users, what's their experience like? So Kotlin seems to kind of fit comfortably in that space, but then also giving you that, actually solving the portability problem. And so, you know, there is a return to native because, you know, people are interested in that. But actually, we also need to run things on VMs and so on. And it seems to sort of say, yeah, this is kind of a solved problem. we can take care of that. This is something we can take care of. So I was quite impressed by just sifting through some of the examples on KTOR, going like, actually, these are fairly simple. And as a non-Kotlin programmer, and who's not in this space either, I'm looking through this like going, this makes sense. And I'm coming at it as not shaking my fist at the cloud. But as I say, you know, this is all subject to change. In 5 years' time, it could turn into a monster. Who knows?
No, that's so actually one of our goals.
We'll put that disclaimer out there. But at the moment, what I was seeing is just like, oh, actually, this does look fairly sane. But maybe I'm getting lured in by the examples. But
that's actually, I mean, to give you some background around KTOR, what happened is that I used to work. You know, I've gone through many platforms, right? And I used to do a lot of .NET. And at the time, I was doing ASP.NET, MVC, and then I got kind of interested in Node.js, and I started to do a bunch of JavaScript, and then I got hooked onto Express.js, and I really, really liked Express.js because it was like back to my roots of ISAPI DLLs, where you just basically had an entry point and you would just execute something, and I loved it. And so when I started to play with Kotlin, there wasn't anything like that, right? There was the Spring framework, and there was the Spring. And so I created this framework called Wasabi, which was basically trying to port Express.js over to Kotlin. And then one of my colleagues that was working on the Kotlin team started to experiment as well with Kotlin as a DSL, and started to create this other thing called KTOR. And then, you know, at some point, we coroutines came out, and of course, it made sense to move to asynchronous. And he had already kind of like started building it on the asynchronous model. Wasabi wasn't, and I'm like, you know, why are we doing two things, right? Yeah. So I said, you know, like, I'm going to drop Wasabi, and I'll help you with KTOR. And then eventually, he stepped aside, and then I took over the team. But we like our essence is to try and keep it really, really simple. And it's funny because you know folks come to us and they're like, oh, you know, if I use Spring or if I use X or if I use Y, I could just like take a class and add an annotation to it and poof, I've got it all done. I'm like, yeah, you do, but that annotation, you pile up seven other annotations and then you don't know what that little line, you know, the class definition is doing. And it starts to become, and we want to be more like explicit. We want you to exactly know what is happening, but at the same time, not be overly verbose. So that's kind of like the balance that we're trying to keep with KTOR.
I kind of like the way you've expressed that. And actually, we can step back from KTOR and actually kind of look at that as a sort of general principle and a general approach. The idea of you should know what is going on and being done on your behalf. You know, you should know what's going on. You know, the fact that something's being done on your behalf should not be a matter of magic and mystery. You know, the annotation stacking, and in fact, there was an interesting one with a dependency injection framework a few years back where, you know, members of a team, a couple of members had kind of led the charge and had ended up with so many subtle edge cases and complexity that they were very subtle uses and dependencies on subtleties in this thing. And it was interesting because they were kind of like, obviously, this is often the case when people lead an architectural effort. You've always got somebody who does know everything because they were present at all of the key design decisions. They have a deep history there. And then you got all the newer developers, and it was really interesting that one of the developers said, "Yeah, I don't really know what's going on. When I have to add in and I extend the code, I basically copy and paste something that's already working and do that because it's just like, well, that's working, and I want something similar and a variation. Copying is one of the most successful human traits. So that's what they do. They do that as they're not being. We need to get away, I think, from the moral judgment. Somebody who duplicates code is bad. No, they're actually doing what is human and safe. It's like I genuinely don't understand that." Is complexity. The way I can manage that complexity
is by copying it.
Yes. And I've taken a thing that already works and now I'm going to adapt it, but I'm going to be really cautious so I don't break it. But I don't genuinely understand how it works, so that's why I'm being cautious. But I am taking a thing that works and that is of value to me. They're being incredibly human. They've done the right thing in that sense. Yeah. The thing that is not right is perhaps the origin story of this. And there we've got, there's a little bit of balance. So we want things to be, we want things to do things on our behalf, because we don't actually want to have to write the whole stack. You know, although there are a couple of developers out there who say, oh yeah, I'm going to do this. This is true craft. I'm going to craft all the bits all the way down to the 68,000 level. You know, and I'm going to build the emulator for that. Yeah, so,
JavaScript.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, you've got that. But the point is, you want things done on your behalf. You want that abstraction. You want that benefit. But at the same time, it shouldn't leave you with a sense of mystery of, I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
You know, because that is effectively what we end up doing. So there's that balance of, like, I've got enough control and I've got enough comprehension. I know what I'm, I can see what I'm doing. Doesn't mean I'm going to do it perfectly, but then somebody else can see what I'm doing, but we still get the benefits of not having to do it all ourselves. And it's a very careful, and I think there's a careful balance there. As you use the word balance very specifically, and I think a lot of design is that. It's just like, you know, there's something that pulls you this way, but there's also something that pulls you this way. We want things done for us, but at the same time, we want to know what it is that we are creating and have that kind of control. Otherwise, it's not our code. We are merely observers who poke it. It should be our code collectively. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that the balance is the hardest thing. And I feel like even myself and many, I guess, that it's so much easier to, instead of trying to keep that balance, fall into the trap of complexity and say, look, it's hard to understand. So you need to be understand all of this. So it's hard to keep simple.
Yeah.
Right. I think that sometimes we don't put enough effort into that balance.
Yeah.
Right. Which I think is where we are now, kind of.
Yeah. I think it's that idea of like, yeah, this stuff is hard. We acknowledge that it's hard. But if we put, but that doesn't mean, but it shouldn't be at the situation of like, well, it was hard to build, so it should be hard to understand.
Exactly, you know? Exactly.
And it shouldn't mean, you know, the idea is like, yeah, it is hard. We're not going to say that it's simple, but we will try and simplify it. But to simplify takes enormous effort. It takes a discipline, doesn't it?
Exactly.
You've got to kind of really focus on that.
Yeah.
Right, well, in that case, thank you very much, Hadi.
Thank you.
And good day and good night. I hope this has been useful to you and that you'll join us for more at another point. 5 years' time.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.